You're listening to Saxon's Creed Radio Show. I'm David James, and I'm your host. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, kinsmen, kinswomen. Welcome to all the brothers and sisters. I think we'll have a good show today, together, you and I. I think that you will like the material. Of course, we're going to be doing some compare. If we have time, we will get to the book of Isaiah. And I want to start off with something else. I like to do these messages where we get three subjects in. Sometimes I just make commentary and then do two subjects, or one commentary and one subject. You know how it works, but I try to do these, and we'll try to get three different types of things in during this show, if possible. I'd like to thank those that have supported me. There's not many of you at this point. I don't know why, but thank you. You're helping keeping me alive, let's say. But let me talk about something else. By the way, if you would like to have, it's a mini flash drive. It's a flash drive that you can put in your radios if they're new, or you can put them in your car radio if they're new enough and they have a USB port. You could get all the compare on a flash drive. Just you can get, it'll also have the Revelation, the 14 parts. And many people that have gotten this really enjoy it and really like it, because I spent a lot of time cleaning these up so that they would be listenable. They weren't listenable, some of them. So, you know, they vary in quality. But if you would like that, contact me at davidjamesboston@gmail.com. You could also get two seasons of Saxon's Creed on one. And I always add extra things in, so it doesn't just... on the compare disc, you know, it's pretty full. But when you realize that if you get a couple of seasons of Saxon's Creed, you're getting about 90 shows or so. And it's well worth it. And it helps to preserve these recordings. And you can transfer them right to your computer and still just use the USB drive for whatever else you want. You know, instead, you know, you can just transfer the shows onto your computer. So contact me at davidjamesboston@gmail.com if you're interested. Okay. I wanted to talk, there's been a book I've been interested in a while, and I have read a little bit of this now that I looked at the first page that I was starting to read, but I think this is important for you to realize. You know, one thing I will say is I'm amazed when the revelations that come out on these shows that the Father is revealing things, and I don't hear much from people. There's an amazing thing that was revealed. It's really two. You know how it says there's one mediator between God and man, and that's Jesus Christ, right? The Word of God. Well, I had revealed, or the Father had revealed and given me the the incredible revelation of that the Jehovah Witnesses write a book that you need to read instead of the Bible. It tells you what to believe in the Bible. It's their own mediator between you and the Word of God. In other words, it's a mediator between you and Jesus Christ. But it says there's only one mediator between God and man. Somehow, and it's a very Jewish thing, there's another middleman been put in with the Jehovah Witnesses Bible. And the same thing is in the Catholic religion with the Pope. He's the vicar of Christ. He sets in place of Christ on the earth, their scriptures say. I mean, their Bible says. Of course, he doesn't sit in place of Jesus Christ at all. He's an antichrist. a Babylonian Jew. But it's interesting that these mediators try to make a lie out of the scriptures. When the scripture says there's only one mediator, they say, oh no, there's another one, and we put ourselves in those positions. And nobody wrote me. Nobody said, oh, that's amazing. I never realized that. That's, you know, of course, all my brothers and sisters, my white brothers and sisters, they know everything. Everything I know, they know everything. Believe me. Even if they don't know it, they know it. But anyway, that's just a little joke for you there. But it is kind of true. People do actually think they know everything. So Fritz Springmeier, I had read from his book on the Rabbit Hole radio show, and Fritz is a shill. There's no doubt about it. He's there to put your ideas onto anything but the Jews, and he says it's not the Jews. Yet, you know, of course, like Bill Cooper, Jews are all over the place. Okay, so he wrote a book called The Watchtower and the Masons, and this is very apropos, a very good subject to do a little teaching on here and there until you get the idea of what really happens and what the Jehovah Witnesses are. You know, you have Masons all around you all the time and you don't know it. You don't know anything about it unless you've studied into it. And you have Jehovah Witnesses all around you. And you don't know what that's all about, and so unless you study it. And so I have studied into it, and it's very interesting. I wouldn't say I'm any expert or anything on, you know, I know quite a bit about Freemasonry, but I wouldn't say I was an expert. There's too many people willing to call themselves experts, you know. If you said, hey, Dave, you know, I know a lot of things about the scriptures, and I know a good deal about them. But if you said, are you an expert? I would say, no, I'm on my way. Because you'll always be learning about the scriptures. You'll always learn something new every time you read them. And so I couldn't really make that claim that I'm a Bible expert or an expert in anything really. But there are people willing to claim they're experts in all kinds of things. And that they're, you know, I don't think that that's ethical. You understand? If you're not a Bible expert, don't claim you are. The Father knows what we are. So anyway, let's look into this. The first chapter is called Strange Vibes. And Fritz starts out, I remember the first time I noticed a volume by the founder of what became the Jehovah's Witnesses. Now, you know, we were reading Comparé, and Comparé talked about how this is not Yahweh's name at all, and that this was done by a Catholic monk. And it was because of the way the scriptures were written, how they were writing, what's the word? It's right on the tip of my tongue here. Adonai, right? And you know how they wrote that instead of the name of Yahweh? So he mixed the two together and came out with the name Jehovah. Okay, but Yahweh's name is Yahweh, not Jehovah. Anyway, I just wanted to clarify that. It was entitled, okay, so this is the first volume by the founder of what became the Jehovah Witnesses. It was entitled Studies in the Scriptures, quote unquote, on its, now get the color of the cover, because it's the same color as the tears. I just want to point this out. On its reddish brown cover, it had the Studies in Scriptures and had a strange winged sun disc with snakes. On my copy, the left snake had a tiny gold tongue protruding from its mouth. This strange new symbol puzzled me. I wondered over its symbolic meaning, But Pastor Russell's book provided not a clue as to the cover's meaning. Obviously, the meaning was for those in the know, quote-unquote, and not the casual reader. Yes, the serpent is known to have wisdom. That's why on the headdresses of the Egyptian pharaohs, they would have a serpent on the top of it, because it was known that it would, you know, be wise as serpents. You see what I mean? So it represented wisdom. By the way, I want to point out that Russell is one of these big Jewilluminati families. You know, Illuminati, ill, I-L-L, 9-11. I'm driving somebody crazy there with that. Oh, yeah. So it goes on. The seven volumes of Charles Taze Russell's Studies in the Scriptures had this strange wing sun disk. And, you know, it's the same one that's on Arrowsmith, you know. It's not exactly the same, but it's the same premise. It's the sun with the wings, the sun god, with the serpents coming out of the top, you see? Russell spoke of the golden age to come. Each volume's title page, capitalized in bold underlined letters, the golden age of prophecy. Not knowing who Russell was, I wasn't aroused by this non-biblical term, golden age, quote-unquote. Notes. The seventh volume was billed as Russell's, but was written by George H. Fisher and C.J. Woodworth. So, he continues, nor did I realize the implication of Russell's strange beliefs in the Great Pyramid. However, I do distinctly remember the first impression as a Christian, this is weird, quote unquote. How does one investigate something strange like this? It does have its difficulties. First, it's like being a policeman who comes upon a suspicious car accident. If he rules it an accident, quote-unquote, rather than a homicide, he will limit his approach in gathering clues. On the other hand, if he assumes the worst and views it as a homicide, he will collect all the evidence he can. This book is an attempt to gather evidence. Yes, the fact that the policeman gathers facts means he's suspicious. It doesn't mean anyone is guilty. Certainly today, Jehovah's Witnesses do not join Masonic lodges and orders. After years of in-depth study of the Jehovah's Witnesses and learning what I could about the Freemasons by talking to Freemasons, talking to ex-Freemasons, reading, going to public lodge events, etc., I offer the following conclusions and cautions when beginning the research. Researching a book on Jehovah's Witnesses and Freemasons, both secretive organizations, you should make a mental note of that, is a challenge. Both publish propaganda based on what they want you to think rather than history. Maury, in The Origin and Teachings of Freemasonry, goes so far as to quote respected Masons who themselves warn other Masons that most of their own history books are in large part fiction and unreliable. I hope you're listening. Not all Masonic writers identify themselves as being Masons. The Jehovah's Witnesses literature is biased and loaded with fictitious information. Several writers have taken them to task for scholastic dishonesty. So you see, several scholars, I'm just reading that again, or several writers have taken them to task for scholastic dishonesty. That is, they have a penchant for misquoting others. Kind of like, you know, the Teflon rabbi. He keeps saying that in 1800, Napoleon let the Jews out. But it wasn't in 1800 at all. And to correct that error, let's see if I can find the little deal. It was done on September 27th. Let me see. I think it's right here. on the 28th, excuse me. But it said 27th in the Napoleon article, so it's a question whether it's September 27th or 28th. But it said, on September 28th, 1791, revolutionary France became the second country of the world after Poland 500 years earlier to emancipate its Jewish population. The 40,000 Jews living in France at that time were the first to confront the opportunities and challenges offered by the emancipation. Okay, so it wasn't 1800. And, you know, what kind of amazes me is I believe we should try to be as accurate as we can. And it's amazing that if you would just start quoting things that this Teflon rabbi says, then people would say, no, that's not the date. Now, if I'm wrong, I'd like you to tell me I'm wrong. But I looked into it, and that's what I've found. You know, if you were saying, well, you know, it happened around 1800, then, you know, that gives you leeway, right? But he keeps claiming it was 1800. That's a false. It's not real. It's not a real fact. This shows you something about the fellow. I don't want to keep mentioning this fellow, but it's just ridiculous nonsense. I keep an ear on EFR just a little bit to see what's going on, but I've kind of lost a lot of interest in it because once you know somebody's a practicing liar, you just can't believe anything they say. Just like you can't believe that Napoleon let them out in 1800. You can't, you know, is he doing that deliberately? I don't think so. Just ignorant, lazy. So let's continue with the Watchtower and the Masons here. So it says they have a penchant for misquoting others. On the other hand, Protestant and Catholic material is biased too, for they may be latching on to superficially learned knowledge in an effort to counteract others. Expect the Mason's bias to be to show their legitimacy and antiquity. Less of this appears in recent times. Expect big differences between European Masonry and American Masonry. Expect to meet both Masonic and non-Masonic writers with the incorrect view that all Freemasons have a common purpose, common beliefs, and common methods. Now, we read that in the Catholic book, didn't we? Just yesterday on Rabbit Hole Radio Show, they said that very thing, that all Freemasons have a common purpose. Interesting that Fritz would say this. Now, it's kind of funny that I'm reading this right now, right? So take it for what it's worth. The Freemasons next door may sincerely believe the Freemasons are innocuous, for he regards his own personal experience as universal without bothering to get an historical perspective. That's an historical, what he says right there, right? Some Masonic groups are not so benign. Any secret organization such as the Masons is a ready-made organization for mischief should scheming men control it. But the non-Mason should be slow to imagine any grand conspiracy scheme. Masonry, even if it leaks an invisible high-level organization, are true. Even if it reeks, even if it reeks of an invisible high-level organization are true, may not be united enough for a single grand scheme. The American Freemasons today, about 3 million strong, experience the lodge mostly in terms of a philanthropic fraternity. Still, expect them to confuse and deceive to protect their secrets. Now, you know, I've talked about that. I don't know if I agree with everything Fritz is saying right here, but it is an evil. It is Antichrist. It's evil, and it's out to destroy Christianity. There's no doubt about it. But anyway, expect the Jehovah Witnesses to portray a selfless, pristine, perfect organization, to hide or gloss over doctrinal controversies, to change history to match present truth, quote-unquote, and to cover over anything embarrassing. Each group has kernels of truth in their positions and biases. Yet truth with embellishments is no longer truth. Very interesting. Good word there, Mr. Fritz. Was discussing that with a brother of ours. And very interesting. See, just think of what he says. Each group has kernels of truth in their positions and biases. Yet truth with embellishments is no longer truth. Get it? But a distortion. In this investigation, you are the jury. Even as this goes to press, the facts and evidence are not all in. In a court of law, every witness has his chance on the stand. There are some sources that are quoted that the author would not endorse without some reservations. As a detective, the goal has been to filter out spurious information, yet consider every relevant fact. A Masonic oath. This is a note. A Masonic oath is repeated by all at the entered apprentice first degree and every degree after it. Now, we were told not to take oaths in the scriptures, correct? And what do Jews do? They do the opposite of what the scripture says, right? And that's what the Masons, that's what the Masons do. So, a Masonic oath is repeated by all at the entered apprentice first degree and every degree after it, and taken on the penalty of mayhem and violent death goes the candidate, I'm not going to say I, the candidate does hereby and hereon most solemnly and sincerely promise and swear that the candidate will always hail, ever conceal, and never reveal any of the arts, parts, or points of the secret arts and mysteries of ancient Freemasonry, which the candidate received. And the candidate is about to receive, or may hereafter be instructed in. Shaw, this is from Jim Shaw, X-33rd degree, and Tom McKenney. The Deadly Deception, Lafayette, L.A., Huntington House, 1988. So, okay, that takes care of that. Now, this is the second chapter, and it says, ideas don't come out of a vacuum. I hope you're paying attention, because this is not a waste of your time in any form or fashion. When something new appears, it is good for us to remember that there is nothing new under the sun. My experience as a world traveler and so see, cognitive dissonance, as my friend always talks about, a history buff, and that I marvel at how much continuity a modern people has with their ancestors. For instance, one day in a restaurant while I was awaiting for a meal, I was studying some ancient Egyptian cursive handwriting from the 19th dynasty. That means this handwriting was about 3,300 years old, and this hieratic and ancient Egyptian cursive is a different system than the modern Arabic script used today in Egypt. An Arab approached me and started a conversation because he thought I was reading Arabic. It caused me to reflect. Now, let me just stop there and make a comment about this. You see what he just said here? Egyptian, this hieratic, it's hieratic, H-I-E-R-A-T-I-C, the ancient Egyptian cursive, is a different system than the modern Arabic script, which, see, these people in the world today are trying to claim that those that are in Egypt today are the people that have always been in Egypt, but it's not true. When Egypt was at its apex and when it used this other hieratic cursive, they were white, the ancient Egyptian cursive. They were white people. When it was at its apex, it was white. And what happened is the same thing that's happening to all the white countries today. They got race mixed. And now there's no white people in Egypt that I know of. They're all brown people now, right? And there you have it. So that's sort of a testimony that this cursive was different 3,300 years ago than it was, than it is now. So he thought I was reading Arabic. It caused me to reflect. The Egyptians had been conquered by the Assyrians, Persians, Greeks, and Romans, and had gone through using various scripts, yet they choose to use the Arabic script, which resembles the hieroglyphic that they used in the centuries before Christ. The word choose, quote unquote, is used on the premise that people are responsible for their behavior. People also tend to build to adapt on past ideas. People tend to borrow rather than create new. When we see something new, quote unquote, arrive in history, such as the alphabet, a person then looks for clues as to when that alphabet was introduced. It is valid then to question where new, quote unquote, ideas come from or spring from. They rarely come from a vacuum. When Charles Taze Russell created a new religious body, his ideas did not come out of a vacuum. Various scholars have tracked down Russell's ideas to all kinds of heresies. Are you listening? Where did all these strange beliefs come from? My early exposure to the Jehovah Witnesses piqued my curiosity. For instance, why call one's meeting place a hall? Why not kingdom meeting or kingdom assembly or kingdom study or church or chapel or tabernacle or temple or something else? Why hall? Why all the secrecy? Why are the writers and the leaders of the Watchtower Society clouded in secrecy? Why have no membership records been kept? The answer is given that it was a security measure in case of persecution didn't satisfy me. Other groups equally persecuted made other choices, choices that are not secretive. They would say, we trust God and that are willing to suffer for him. So why be secretive? What have we got to hide? The choice to be secretive is just that, choice. And that decision and other attitudes are installed from the top down. That is, from the Watchtower president and now the governing body down the pyramid, quote unquote, to the masses of JWs, Jehovah Witnesses. The answer to where Jehovah Witnesses receive their strange beliefs, strange doctrines, and attitudes comes primarily from two men. Because primarily only two men, Charles Taze Russell and Joseph F. Rutherford, made all the decisions of the Watchtower Society from the beginning, 60 years. It is important to understand their overwhelming contribution. Now, this is a note. Charles Taze Russell was born in 1906 and Joseph F. Rutherford in 1915. It continues. Charles Taze Russell's father was Joseph L. Russell. Joseph L. was a Presbyterian and married one Joseph L. left Ireland and immigrated. Huh? So he changed his name? Is that what it means? Oh, he married a Presbyterian. Okay. Joseph L. left Ireland and immigrated directly to Allegheny, Pennsylvania in 1846. He left during the potato famine. So obviously the potato famine was going on in 1846, okay? There's a little historic mark for you. It was the time when every village in Scotland and Britain had a Masonic lodge. Also during the years just prior to Joseph L. immigrating to the U.S., Joseph L. experienced along with his Presbyterian churches, the atonement heresies that broke out in 1841 and lasted for several years. The atonement heresies. The heresies concerned the extent of Christ's atonement, along with some leaders adopting the Arian view of Christ. Several synods were cut off and some offenders disfellowshipped. The author hasn't confirmed which side of the disputes Joseph was on, but there are indications. So there's an Arian view of Christ, and this is spelled A-R-I-A-N, not A-R-Y-A-N. Charles Taze Russell's mother was Anne Eliza Birney, B-I-R-N-E-Y, Russell. That was her last name, yes. Her family was from northern counties of Ireland, where she was born in Ulster. She had Charles's older brother in 1850, Charles in 52, and his sister, Margaret M. When she died at the age of 37, Charles was only 9. Hello. Charles's father was a purposeful and motivated person. He started a business soon after arriving in America. At age 11, his son Charles wrote up a contract which made him and his father partners in his clothing store. This would develop into a chain of five men's clothing stores. Pastor Russell would buy his father's store in 1884. His father would get land in Florida. Charles grew up zealously accepting the Presbyterian worldview and heritage of his parents. His personality took him on a journey that left the Presbyterian Church in many ways. His worldview reflected his heritage, and it was basically established by the end of his teenage years. His father, at the age of 54, joined Russell's group and worked in accord with Charles until his death in 1897. One of his uncles, also named Charles T. Russell, and who also had a store, was sympathetic of Russell's later religious course and left Charles T. Jr. a large sum of money. The sum greatly increased Charles's wealth. He invested some of the money. Considering the evidence, Charles's doubts about Orthodox Christian doctrines may have been a reflection of his father's doubts. Perhaps his mother's early death furthered his serious and intense religious nature. His father promoted his maturity and independence by giving him so much responsibility early in life. He was privately tutored besides attending public school. Charles had a strong personality. He excluded ideas and behavior that didn't harmonize with his own ideas and principles. He had an abundance of business and organizational abilities. He was organized and precise with details. He was cultured and a good analytical thinker, but his narrow-mindedness and prejudices prevented him from considering the merit of views, ideas, and practices differing from his own. It is important also to realize that his intense personality absorbed emotional experiences to a greater extent than most people, and that these feelings endured longer, were retained longer than most people do. This is the picture of a very capable, multi-talented person who sets out on his own track, determined to control his own destiny, and who cannot be deterred by anyone. Those concepts he embraced early in life set his course. Perhaps because of his father's good nature, Charles Taze Russell found it difficult to conceive that his heavenly father would eternally punish people. This difficulty caused him to reject the doctrine of hell, and then had further consequences. He uses the word person, I'm going to change it to man. A man does not reject the eternal punishment spoken of in the scriptures without having to make some major revisions in other doctrines too. Charles's father agreed with Charles's revelations, quote-unquote, about the baptism by immersion and the doctrinal error of hell, he joined him in 1874 in a group studying the Bible. One possible explanation for why Charles Taze Russell turned so avidly to supposedly hidden knowledge is that it provided mental solace, a type of protection of the psyche against such unknown forces that would take his mother at a tender age. Some people are continually threatened by unforeseen and unavoidable problems. Death, hunger, poverty, and sickness surprise them. The causes are secret and unknown. They are reduced to a state of perpetual suspense and perplexed. I love that word. I like to use that word. To an account for the random distribution of these calamities. The unknown forces or causes become the focus of these people's hopes and fears. Subsequently, their imaginations aid them by providing explanations about these causes for which these threatened individuals have such a dependence on. This describes the route or route Russell took. That is, later when he sought answers, he would seek it from those who had hidden knowledge and revelations. What about the route Russell took? First, he rejected his Presbyterian church for the more liberal Congregational church. There was just one in town, a Welsh Congregational church. When he rejected the Congregational church, when he tried to convert an infidel, quote-unquote, friend, one source says pool hall friend, quote-unquote, he was unable to defend his religion to his friend, especially why a just God would torment people in hell. This caused him to question his minister and a professor from the Allegheny Theological Seminary about the Bible's reliability. They did not answer him to his satisfaction, so he rejected Christianity, and he requested, get that right away now, he rejected, first he rejected the initial church, then he rejected the next church he went into, and now, ultimately, he has now rejected Christianity. This is the founder of the Jehovah Witnesses. So think of the gravity of this, right? And he also requested a letter of dismissal from the church. His steps to peace and away from the orthodoxy, according to his own words, were first a total rejection of scriptural authorities, then a reliance upon himself, then a peace of heart, and then finally a desire for revelation. In an interview with the Jamestown Evening Journal, Saturday, August 6, 1910, Russell says that after rejecting Christianity, I bowed my knee and worshipped an unknown God. Ladies and gentlemen, who do you think that unknown God is? Huh? I bowed my knee and worshipped an unknown God, saying, Great Creator who made me, I reverence thee. My heart found rest. This started me to look for a divine revelation. He became intrigued with the religious ideas that called for an imagination and a belief in mysteries and hidden knowledge. During Charles Taze Russell's early years, there was a group which his upbringing exposed him to, which had just the type of religious knowledge that Russell had a penchant for. That was the Masonic Hall, located near his father's dry goods store on Federal Street, another 8 blocks south, across the St. Clair Street Bridge, was another Masonic Hall. In 1851, in the Pittsburgh Allegheny area, there were 52 lodges of various kinds of Freemasons and Odd Fellows, including a Scottish Rite Lodge. By 1856, the Allegheny Lodge had moved their hall a short distance from Federal Street to Water Street near Federal. Two lodges met there, Allegheny Lodge No. 223 and Jefferson Lodge No. 288. By 1858, Pittsburgh had its own Masonic Knights Templar Commandery. More on this later. Russell was born in Allegheny, Pennsylvania, obviously, and lived there from 1852 to 1909. There he was born. That's funny that he was born in 1852 and it said earlier 1910 or something, whatever. So just disregard that. This is this has been corrected twice now. So the year he was born, 7 of the 20 churches in Allegheny were Presbyterian. Also of interest was the close presence of a Swedenborg New Jerusalem church and the lone Jewish synagogue for the area. By 1856, there was a grand total of 23 churches in the city. There's your 23 again, right? Jachin and Boaz, or DNA. 23 pairs of chromosomes. 8 of these churches being Presbyterian. This means, speaking in percentage, that 35% of the town's churches were Presbyterian. This shows the heavy concentration of Scot-Irish immigrants in the area. The Presbyterian churches dominated western Pennsylvania at the time. Further, some Presbyterians Russell grew up around took an active role in the Masonic Hall. Note that a Presbyterian minister, James Anderson, was responsible for the creation of modern Freemasonry. Let me read that again. Note that a Presbyterian minister, James Anderson, you've heard of the Anderson family, haven't you? You know that's a high muckety muck. You know the queer Anderson there? No, that's that's not his last name, right? His first name is Anderson Cooper, right? And of course, he's from a big family. Sorry, I mistook that. Okay, so it continues. Presbyterian ministers in Russell's day played an important role in various lodges. This has continued Presbyterian minister James Allen Cabinus wrote the Grand Lodge of Mississippi's official history. John McCarty, a contemporary of Charles Taze Russell and a Presbyterian minister, also wrote a Masonic book. Anglican and Presbyterian ministers in the British Isles have been known to lose their jobs for speaking out against the Masons. Are you listening? Why were the Presbyterians so prominent in the Masons? The answer goes back to where the modern Freemasons began. The modern rites began in the British Isles. I thought it was 1717, but he's saying, well, I believe it was, right. But, okay, the modern rites began in the British Isles. The Scot-Irish began one of these. The Irish Grand Lodge was formed in 1725, and the Scotch the following year. The Irish played a special role in establishing the Pennsylvania lodges. So, although the Masons are now spread throughout the world, when Charles Taze Russell grew up, it was still primarily a Scot-Irish-English-blooded membership. Masonry, with its undefined deism, was very close to Voltaire's rationalism. The laws of nature and the reason play a vital role in this philosophy. See, I was going to mention Thomas Jefferson being a deist. Jefferson's deism, which is enunciated so clearly in the Declaration of Independence, was quite appropriate for its signatories. For 8 are confirmed Masons: Benjamin Franklin, John Hancock, Joseph Hughes, and others, and 24 other signatories. So, let me see here. It says, and 24 other signatories, on less certain evidence, may have been Masons. 17 presidents have been Masons, and all these 17 had English or Scot-Irish ancestry. These 17 are Washington, Madison, Monroe, Jackson, Polk, Buchanan, Andrew Johnson, Garfield, McKinley. Now, when I said Polk, I saw a strike of lightning. Very interesting. And now the thunder is thundering. So Buchanan, Andrew Johnson, Garfield, McKinley, both Roosevelts, Taft, Harding, Truman, Lyndon Johnson, Gerald Ford, and Ronald Reagan. 17 vice presidents have also been Masons. Note that the first three presidents were affiliated with the Episcopal Church, and the next three Masons to become U.S. presidents were Presbyterians. Presidents are not the only Scot-Irish Freemason leaders. Joseph Smith's Masonic membership is proven. Did you hear that? And Mary Baker Eddy's close ties with the Freemasons are documented. These are the people that started other religions, you know. And I told you that the Mormons do the first three degrees of Freemasonry. Okay, so now Mary Baker Eddy, you've heard of her, right? Baker being a Jew name, very interesting. I'm not sure about anything about her, but these people that started these things are not, I don't know. That's all I can say. So, and Mary Baker Eddy had Eddy's close ties with the Freemasons are documented. Her first and beloved husband died and left her a widow. He was a Freemason. The Freemasons took care of her as a widow, and after that kindness, she was very close to them for her entire life. She had material published in the Freemasons monthly magazine. Ideas don't come out of a vacuum. So it shows some things here. Let's see where we are time-wise. Oh, it's time to take a break, ladies and gentlemen. Let's listen to the song that I did in, I think it was last year or so, or the year before.
Watchmen on the wall today. Calling on Yahweh's holy soldiers, and I'm calling on them today. Get off the fence now. You've gotta choose whether to win now, brother, or whether you want to lose. Make up your mind now and do it real, real soon. Study all the scriptures and begin to sing in tune. Calling on Yahweh's holy soldiers, and I'm calling on them today. Calling on Yahweh's holy army, and I'm calling for them to pray. Standing on Yahweh's holy mountain, watchmen on the wall today. Calling on Yahweh's holy soldiers, and I'm calling on them today. You know the time is right now. Right now, right away. Yes, I know it. Put on all your armor, soldier, and don't you be afraid. Ooh, yeah. You got the right now. Speak your mind today. I pray. Never give a place to evil, and don't you go astray.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Saxon's Creed radio show from my home of davidjamesboston.com. Yes, visit davidjamesboston.com. You should read my articles in the blog. You can hear my music. You can see my artwork, my Pink Floyd artwork. I suggest you check out the articles, Pigs, Dogs, and Sheep. Well, this is quite interesting, and it's very good for us to know the foundation of this particular organization. So let's continue. Churches, the Watchtower and the Masons. Churches publicly stand pro or anti-Mason. In 1831 to 1838, a strong anti-Freemason, it should say, well, anti-Freemasonic campaign hit Pennsylvania. Campaigns would hit prior and end during Russell's life, just like the anti-liquor and anti-abortion campaigns of the future. Churches had to take a stand for or against Freemasonry. Most of the denominations did take a stand against the secret Freemasons for a while. In Allegheny, there were three Presbyterian churches inside town while Russell grew up, and another 13 Presbyterian churches in the country that kept records. There were five different types of Presbyterian churches in the West, in Western Pennsylvania. The Reformed Presbyterian Church, Evangelical Synod, the Cumberland Presbyterian Church, Association Presbyterian Church, the Presbyterian Church, and the United Presbyterian Church of North America, formed by merging in 1858 at Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, both the Associate Presbyterian Church and the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church. The more liberal of these had members who were Masons. A few denounced Masonry. You see how we've been divided and divided and divided and divided and divided and divided, which weakened everything. And this is why when I tell you that you need to forget about these institutions and forget about worshiping men, and you need to have a relationship with the Father. Think of how strong we would be if just 5% of the Christians worldwide turned to the Father for a personal relationship and said, forget about. See, they couldn't pigeonhole us. They couldn't divide us anymore. Unless we were trying to divide over silly things, you know. Once the Father is the focus of everything, doctrinal issues, we wouldn't have to really worry about them so much. Is that, you know, what I say is, if we don't agree on the Sabbath being sun up to sun up or sundown to sundown or any of these things, we don't have to agree on those things. We don't even know what the real date is on the calendar anymore. Everything's all messed up. And so there's no point splitting over these types of things. We should just say the Father will let us know when we're in the kingdom. So when he says today is the Sabbath in the kingdom, we'll observe the Sabbath. That's it. It's just that simple. We don't have to split up over these things. But anyway, let's continue. By 1889, the Masons had gained ground within the churches. The Alabama Grand Lodge reported that that year, out of its 7,950 Freemasons in the state, 483 were Christian ministers. Hello. This is right out of Bailey's book, you know. She talks about how that's what would happen today. But it was already happening. And let me mention to you that you know that the Baptists are, I mean, just saturated with Freemasonry. You do know that, right? So here, out of the 7,950 Freemasons in the state, 483 of them were Christian ministers. The New York Grand Lodge report of 1890 gives us a breakdown of the 703 Christian clergymen that were New York Masonic members. Methodists, 288. Episcopalians, 146. Baptist, 112. Presbyterian, 59. Universalist, 31. Congregationalist, 21. Dutch Reformed, 13. Christian, 13. Lutheran, the second. Jewish, oh, excuse me, Lutheran, 11. Jewish, 7. Unitarian, 1. Reformed Jew, 1. It is clear that Russell rejected the Presbyterian and the congregational churches that he belonged to because they believed in hell, and not because they allowed Freemasons within their congregations. A study of Russell's life shows no interest on his part of joining the anti-Masonic campaign. The worst enemy of the Masonic Lodge was the Catholic Church. In modern times, the Masons have successfully obtained supporters and a few members from their longtime opponent, the Catholic Church. When Russell was 33, hello, Pope Leo the 13th, remember, Pope Leo's the one that I was reading from in that book, The Plot Against the Church, just yesterday on Rabbit Hole Radio Show. Now, so when Russell was 33, Pope Leo the 13th made it anathema for Catholics to join the Masons. This act drew no acclaim from Russell. Russell refers to the Catholic Church as the Jezebel of 2 Kings 9. Listen to this again. Russell refers to the Catholic Church as the Jezebel of 2 Kings chapter 9. Isn't that interesting that it would be chapter 9? In his second volume, page 256, and Russell does not seem to echo the Masons Albert Pike, Mazzini, and others in his strong anti-Catholic attacks. I mean, he does seem to echo the Masons Albert Pike, Mazzini, and others in his strong anti-Catholic attacks, who also, like Russell, branded the Pope and his hierarchy as agents of the Antichrist. Both Russell and these men call the Catholic Church Babylon the Great. Well, I can't disagree with them. But while they're pointing accusations at somebody else, they're a Babylonian institution themselves. I think that's quite... It's hypocrisy at its apex. Continuing. Considering Russell rejected the Protestant doctrines, it seemed rather Masonic-like that he dislikes the Catholics to such an extreme. Reading Russell's series of sermons advocating the Protestant denominations to merge highlights how much he lumped them together. In Thy Kingdom Come, 1891, I guess this is his book, the defilements and persecutions of the Pope are mentioned. True, other religious men referred to the Catholic Church as Babylon the Great. But the Watchtower Society, after Russell, would take a much less prejudiced view. They would hate Catholics and Protestants equally. In other words, they just hate Christians. But you see, Catholics, when I talk about not disliking the Catholic Church, I'm not saying that I hate Catholic people. They're caught in a snare that they don't even understand. So they hate both Catholics and Protestants equally. There does seem then to be some justification to see his anti-Catholic behavior as more than simply a doctrinal disagreement. This is displayed in Russell's world tour. Russell seems to have connections to people he'd never met. Masonic connections, Masonic help. At any rate, Russell concludes at the end of the world tour that there was no market for his message in Catholic countries. He felt his message would be marketed in England, Scotland, Ireland, and Scandinavia, which by then Scandinavia had a strong Masonic membership. Remember that King Gustavus V of Sweden was Grand Master of Sweden, and King Edward VII of England was at one point Grand Master of England's Freemasons. If Russell really believed in his message and that God was behind him, why did he feel heathens would come more readily than Catholics to his message? Now, if the Masons were supporting him, this might offer an explanation that would make this more understandable. Russell claimed to have spent 2 years after he rejected the Congregational Church studying Eastern religions. In one sermon, he lists several like Buddhism, but adds that there were others. The author has read much of what Russell wrote and said, and has yet to see evidence of in-depth knowledge on the part of Russell towards Buddhism, Hinduism, or Islam. This author theorizes that the Eastern religions he studied were most likely that of the Masonic Eastern Star, what they would study, such as the study of Egyptian and Middle East paganism that is so important to Masonry. Did you hear that? The study of Egyptian and Middle East paganism. Russell and his followers held meetings during the 1906-1907 time period at the Eastern Stars Temple on Sunday nights at 7:30. By the way, men do join and lead the order of the Eastern Star, even though it is considered a woman's organization. The only connection that the author has found between OES, Order of the Eastern Star, and Russell are his meetings there. But it can be asked, what Masonic symbolism was Russell's astute mind exposed to? It is important to bear in mind that Russell was adept at picking and choosing within his mind the facts, arguments, and evidences that he cared to regard. It can be depended upon that Russell accepted new information which he was predisposed to accept. His shell was so hard to penetrate because he was a good speaker, had exceptional abilities to bluff, to feign confidence, and maintain himself before audiences in situations where others would have lost face. These all contributed to his ability to filter out what he didn't want to accept. Interesting there, let's just stop there. For this technique, we find other people able to do this too, don't we? Listen. His shell was hard to penetrate because he was a good speaker. That's one. He had exceptional abilities to bluff. That's two. If you're bluffing people, hello. And to feign confidence, that's three. And to maintain himself before audiences in situations where others would have lost face. You think about that for a little while. A scholar of Charles Taze Russell commented once that it is unknown when Russell became Arian. Arian referring to Annus's, believe it or not, heresy. It says A-N-U-S with the apostrophe, Annus's heresy, in believing that Christ is only a good man and not Almighty God. Okay, let's stop right there. Then what does that make Charles Taze Russell? I'm gonna take a sip of my coffee here. If he has, so now we know what the Arian thing that split up the Presbyterian Church over there with the Arian belief. We now know that the Arian belief means that Christ was only a good man and not Almighty God. What does that tell you about Charles Taze Russell and the Arian version, that's A-R-I-A-N version of Presbyterian Church? What does that tell you? You're correct. They're Antichrist. Charles Taze Russell is Antichrist. He rejected Christianity, and now he's rejected Christianity's Messiah. And he bowed his knee to another God, the unknown God. But this isn't the unknown God the Apostle Paul talked about. You get it? Let's continue. Mr. James Penton, in his excellent work, Apocalypse Delayed, writes on page 14, quote, "Much attention has been devoted to Russell's concepts and teachings. Surprisingly, little has been paid to the sources thereof, either by his friends or by his enemies, unquote. Penton does a good job of accurately portraying Russell as an honest man, albeit often the victim of his own sincere, misguided self-deception. So when Russell obviously lies under oath in a court of law to protect his friends, see page 57, and does it without remorse or difficulty, does this mean he was, after all, dishonest? Russell, in general, lived up to his beliefs. He was, as people go, an honest person. The author believes the answer lies in the Masonic concept that to lie to protect a brother is not a lie, but the truth. Now, let me stop right there. That's the end, justify the means, right? And then, to conceal hidden knowledge is not to lie to them. Indeed, it is their moral duty to deceive in order to protect the truth, quote unquote. Can you see the double speak, the double mindedness, the double think? Let me read it again for you so you can really just take a deep breath and listen, because this is important thing. These are important things that are being pointed out here. The author believes, that's Fritz, the answer lies in the Masonic concept that to lie to protect a brother is not a lie, but the truth. To conceal hidden knowledge is not to lie, a lie to them. Indeed, it is their moral duty to deceive in order to protect truth, quote unquote. Such a concept is not scriptural, nor is it taught by the Christian churches, including the Adventist groups Russell associated with. Therefore, it behooves us to open our minds to the option that he learned it from the Masons. What about his Arian views? Did Pastor Russell get these? Pastor, another pastor. Pass the pastor. Yes, Pastor. Good morning, Pastor so-and-so. Hi, Pastor so-and-so. How are you? Pass the pastor, Pastor so-and-so. Here's Pastor Russell. What about his Arian views? Did Pastor Russell get these from the Masons? The Masonic doctrine does not recognize Christ as Almighty God. Individuals on the lower levels may possibly hold their own views. However, it appears that Russell's heresy goes deeper than that. It may have created an atmosphere conducive for him to investigate Freemasonry. But the heresy probably derived from his heritage. His heritage? Yes. The author concurs with Penton that little attention has been given to the sources of Russell's beliefs. When attention has been directed towards them, people have studied the Adventists, I guess the Seventh-day Adventists, right, and totally neglected to focus on his family. This has been a serious oversight. The author believes it is time to correct this. Charles Taze Russell not only worked hand-in-hand with his father, Joseph L. Russell, in business, but also in their religious endeavors. There is not the slightest trace of discord between the father and son. The whole tenor of their relationship and cooperation leads the author to conclude that Charles derived some of his thinking from his father. When Charles started a Bible study, it was not long before his father joined him in his little group. During the 1880s, both father and son married two Ackley sisters, Maria F. and Melinda P., both of which were supportive of the religious route they were taking. Maria helped Russell write his books and contributed articles in the Watchtower magazines. Later, he lost his wife to divorce and his father to death in the same year of 1897. Both Russell and his father were businessmen who went out and marketed C.T. Russell's views, Charles Taze Russell. The rest of their family seemed to help out. Russell's sister, who worked side by side with him for years, felt he was the greatest man alive. Charles Taze Russell obviously was not violating his father's own beliefs when he went off on these wild heresies early on in life. Indeed, Charles and his sister Margaret stated that he had been chosen before he was born for his religious work. Perhaps Joseph L., like Joseph Kennedy, who had goals for his son to be president, had goals for Charles. And if Charles had not been encouraged to go forward in such things, then that could help account for his sister's great admiration for him. He had fulfilled her father's wishes. Now, let me stop there. Don't you find it interesting that he takes on this Arian view that Christ is just a good man and not God, which is Antichrist, and the father just goes along with it? In other words, he's going to support his son no matter what his son believed. If his son said the devil is God, he would have supported him, and his family would have supported him too. The blind guides leading the blind into the pit, another example of it. You see? Very interesting. This stuff is very, very interesting. And I don't know if I would have ever expected these kinds of things, right? But this is something important for us to know, to understand the foundation of the Jehovah Witnesses. Let's continue here. His sister Margaret outlined how God planned and chose her brother when she gave a testimony at Put-in Bay Convention. God planted a seed with the early church, but the seed lay dormant for centuries. In due time, quote unquote, the seed of truth grew and was watered according to God's plan. Well, you know, it's what's funny is she's saying it's God's plan, but which God? The one he bowed his knee to, right? The unknown God? And remember that Alice Bailey and Foster Bailey, they wrote a book called Running God's Plan, but it's not Yahweh's plan at all. Understand the rhetoric. Don't be confused by it. During the Dark Ages, the seed of truth was barely kept alive, waiting for God's chosen one to bring it to fruition. When it was time, God anointed the eyes, quote unquote, of her brother at age 17, and God's smile of favor rested upon him. Her brother was the faithful one that God could depend on. The one who, despite the burden and the heat of the day, would be the faithful one for God. Now, isn't that interesting? You know that the one that is faithful to the Father, of course, is the Word of God, Jesus Christ, or Yeshua. Right? This is another replacement, another mediator between, you see? You see how this is all shaping up here now? Perhaps too much attention has been given to the men that Russell listened to, and not enough to why he listened to them. Why was Charles predisposed to listen to George Storrs, Bobber, and Patton, not General Patton? If we consider George Storrs, for instance, that's Storrs, here is the man, second only to Pastor Russell's father, to have influenced Charles. Russell wasn't a blank mind being impressioned by a venerated teacher, but rather Charles rejected some of Storrs' strongest beliefs, such as his militant anti-slavery stand. Oh, a social justice warrior. It wasn't that Charles was awed by the man. It was because they shared common views that made them friends. Because they shared mutual views on Christ and the atonement, and Charles then liked his conditionalism, that is his forceful views against immorality of the soul, which supported Russell's disdain for the doctrine of hell. Now you see, if they shared common views and mutual views on Christ and the atonement, that means that they were both antichrist. You understand what I'm saying? I'm just connecting that for you. The impression sometimes written is that Russell met Storrs and was led by Storrs to all these heresies. On the contrary, Charles met Storrs because he shared those heresies. Charles just needed someone to provide the accurate defense of those views. Charles didn't immediately know all the ins and outs. Now, remember when the faker, Professor Truth, when he split, when the Father rejected him. That's exactly what he did. He was seeking for people that had the same views as his. So he looked to Hogsley. And don't think I've forgotten. I will get to the Hogsley thing. Don't you worry about it. It's on the long list of things to do. I should have done it right away, but I didn't. I was just too busy. You see, he went out looking for people that agreed with him that Yahweh, the name of Yahweh, is the devil's. And that's exactly what happened here. This is how people end up in heresy. So it said, the impression sometimes written is that Charles Russell met Storrs and was led to Storrs by all these heresies. Listen carefully. On the contrary, Charles met Storrs because he shared those heresies. Charles just needed, listen carefully, Charles just needed Nashab. Charles just needed someone to provide the accurate defense of those views. Charles didn't immediately know all the ins and outs to support his early ideas. He didn't know the full consequences of his sometimes vague and confused ideas. But there seems to be evidence that Charles's father came over from the old country with Arianism and unorthodox atonement views. Charles was never instilled with orthodox views of Christ and the atonement. Consequently, there was never a rebellion against his father. What we're looking at is a long legacy of heresy. This is so important, what is being said in this book. You must realize that there are many heresies. So let me continue. We are running out of time here. Well, we got about 10-ish minutes or something, 9 minutes. So, one could perhaps start the story with the terrible period of Northern Ireland known as the period of the Black Frost, quote-unquote, on the evening of December 26, 1739. A frost appeared that remained until February 15th. The sun seldom was seen, and the frost was unusually dark in appearance. Consequently, famines and unproductive harvest followed afterwards. Now, I've never heard of the Black Frost. Is that not interesting? Again, on the evening of December 26th, 1789, a frost appeared that remained until February 15th. The sun seldom was seen, and the frost was unusually dark in appearance. Consequently, famines and unproductive harvests followed afterwards. Now, didn't we find out that the potato famine came in 1846, if I remember correctly, right? Let's continue. A scheme was approved to create the Widow's Fund, quote-unquote. Long story short, the Widow's Fund, quote-unquote, brought the large majority of Orthodox Presbyterians in close contact with unorthodox Presbyterians, whom they had shunned. The General Synod, that's S-Y-N-O-D, being Orthodox, was fearful of any reconciliation, but the establishment of the widow's fund created an opportunity in an avenue for the non-subscribers to begin fellowshipping with the Orthodox majorities. Now, at this time, all the young men from Ulster who wanted to be ministers went to the University of Glasgow, Scotland. There they were instructed by Professor Simpson, who taught them Arian views. In other words, who taught them Antichrist views. I hope you Arian brothers are listening. Again, there they were instructed by Professor Simpson, who taught them Arian views. Thomas Boston turned out to be the only minister who took a stand against this heresy. For that, he would be named Athanasius, after the defender of the Trinity of the 4th century. Athanasius. Athanasius. That's interesting. As the decades of controversy would reveal, many of the other professors also happened to be Arian in belief. Let me stop there again. Arian in belief means they believe that Christ is a good man, but he is not God in the flesh, which the Bible will tell you, or the scriptures will tell you, that means they are Antichrist, just like the Jew in belief. So it took many years before the judicatories, they call them judicators over there, of the Church of Scotland took the mild action of suspending Professor Simpson. After another heretic professor was Dr. Francis Hutcheson, professor of moral philosophy in Glasgow. He possessed a natural eloquence, and students flocked from all over the British Isles to be dazzled by him. He writes this as to be dazzled by him, and we have the word bedazzled, you see. Shall I look it up? I think I should. We'll have to write meaning, I guess. To bedazzle, greatly impress someone with outstanding ability or striking appearance. Bedazzled by him, they offered him a job in Paris. Second definition, decorate or personalize clothing or accessories using sequins, beads, glitter, etc. Let's see, dictionary.com. To impress forcefully, especially so as to make obvious to faults or shortcomings. To dazzle so as to blind or confuse. To dazzle so as to blind or confuse. The glare of the headlights bedazzled him. And I would say the glare of the distorted light of Lucifer will bedazzle and has bedazzled our people. My, time is just flying by. Tempus fugit, time flies. It appears the young minds of the students were not as discerning as the average Presbyterians. For instance, when Hutcheson substituted for his father at his father's church, the congregation got up and all walked out during his sermon. One of the elders meeting his father said, "We a feel muckle way for your mishap, you silly son. Frank has a fashed a congregation wi' his idle cackle. Ah, for he has been a babbling this oor aboot a good and benevolent God, and that the souls of the heathens themselves will gang to heaven. Not a word does this daft boy can speer, nor say aboot the good old comfortable doctrines of election, reprobation, original sin, and faith." That's sort of a Scottish way of saying it. Imagine they walked out on him because they knew he was full of crap, and they knew that immediately that he was false. But isn't it funny, this little thing? Listen to this. "We a feel muckle way for your mishap, your silly son, Frank, has fashed the congregation with his idle cackle." His idle cackle. My friend gave the Teflon rabbi, one of our brothers gave the Teflon rabbi, he calls him a cackling hen, or, you know, basically, that's what he says. He's always cackling. Very interesting that this fellow with heresy is a cackler as well. So generations of young susceptible minds were led into heresy by the staff of this university. This theological training explains why Ulster County churches were Arian in view for many years, and how the New Light movement was able to steady progress and ultimately take over control of the Synod of Ulster, Ireland. We're going to stop right there. We're on page 28. And I must say, this is pretty incredible. Very, very good expose by Springmeier. I hope that you will try to understand what's being said here and about these heresies. This Arian, A-R-I-A-N, which is not the spelling of the Arian Brotherhood. But these Arian teachings were Antichrist. You understand that? And that's what's most important. See, I've never heard of these Arian teachings. And I would think that you never have either. So it's important that we learn. We're learning together. We're understanding new things and understanding these so-called religions. Now, I know, it may say this later in this book, but I know that the Jews came and listened to Charles Taze Russell. They loved his sermons. Why? Because they had the same ideas as him. They were anti-Christ. He was not promoting Christ and promoting the gospel of Jesus Christ, the gospel that Paul says, if anyone come and bring you another gospel than the one we've given you, let him be accursed. He was promoting the same gospel as the Jews, in a sense, the Antichrist. You've been listening to Saxon's Creed Radio Show. I'm David James, and until next time, study to show thyself approved.